How do you take a story where the main character literally cannot speak, see, or hear, and somehow turn it into the loudest, most visually explosive Broadway hit of the 1990s?
It sounds impossible, honestly.
Right. I mean, if you have ever put on a pair of headphones, closed your eyes, and just
But
let an entire album wash over you, you know that your brain does a lot of the heavy lifting.
oh, totally. You're inventing the scenery, the faces, all of it.
Exactly, you imagine the characters. But what happens when you have to take that entirely internal private experience and build it out of wood, steel, and living actors in front of a couple thousand people every single night?
That is the big question.
Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we have a really fascinating mission. We are looking at a stack of sources, specifically diving into the comprehensive Wikipedia article detailing the life, the evolution, and the massive cultural footprint of the Who's Tommy.
Yeah, we are mapping the journey of how a groundbreaking 1969 rock concept album by the band The Who was translated into this definitive piece of modern musical theater.
And it's not just a history lesson.
No, not at all. We will look at the mechanics of that adaptation, but more importantly, what the shifting narrative of this story reveals about society's obsession with celebrity, the long shadows of trauma, and honestly, our endless appetite for false messiahs.
I am so excited to get into this because this isn't just a recap of a Broadway play. We're looking at this as a study of a cultural phenomenon. Tommy is a story that has constantly reinvented itself over the decades, just to reflect the times.
It really has.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because before we can even begin to understand the narrative of Tommy, we have to look at the immense challenge of getting this completely unconventional project onto the stage.
Yeah, I mean, adapting Tommy is essentially like trying to turn a surrealist painting into a detailed architectural blueprint.
That's a great way to put it.
Right. Pete Townsend, who is the original creator and songwriter from The Who, teamed up with theater director Des Mekaniff, and they had this enormous, almost overwhelming task ahead of them.
They absolutely did. Because when you are listening to that 1969 concept album, the transitions between the songs and the literal actions of the characters are, well, they're completely ambiguous.
Oh, entirely. The listener fills in all the gaps.
Yeah, so to make this work for the stage, Townsend and Mekaniff had to write the book for the musical.
And we should probably clarify that for the listener, because when we say write the book in theater terms, we aren't talking about a novel.
Good point. No, writing the book means creating the actual script.
Exactly. It is the connective dialogue, the stage directions, the actual narrative structure that logically moves a character from scene A to scene B. They couldn't just rely on the lyrics anymore.
Right, because the adaptation process inherently forces creators to make definitive choices. If a character is standing on stage, you have to decide, what year is it? What are they wearing? What are their specific motivations in that exact moment?
You can't just be a vibe anymore. It has to be concrete.
And whatever choices they made in that writing room, they clearly struck a massive chord. I was looking through the production history, and this wasn't just some fringe experimental run that faded away.
Far from it. The show actually premiered at the La Jolla Playhouse in San Diego in 1992, and the momentum was so undeniable there that it transferred to Broadway the very next year.
1993, right?
Yeah, 1993. And it ran at the St. James Theater for 900 performances.
Wow, 900, that's huge.
It was a smash. It took home 5 Tony Awards, including Best Direction for Mekaniff and Best Original Score for Townsend. They even won a Grammy for the cast album.
So how did they actually build that narrative foundation? Because to understand a character who spends most of the story completely catatonic, you have to clearly establish the inciting incident.
Right, the trauma that starts it all.
Yeah. And to make this work for a 1990s theater audience, I understand they literally shifted time itself, like they changed the years.
They did. And the timeline evolution across the different versions of Tommy is one of the most revealing aspects of its entire history.
Let's get into that.
So, in the stage musical, we open with a prologue montage set in London in 1940. Captain Walker meets Mrs. Walker, they marry, and then, amidst the chaos of World War II, the captain parachutes into Germany and is captured as a prisoner of war.
And back home, the military brass show up at Mrs. Walker's door with the official notice. She's pregnant, she believes she is a widow now, and she eventually tries to rebuild her life.
Which is completely understandable.
Totally. So by 1945, Tommy is 4 years old, the war is over, and Mrs. Walker is celebrating her 21st birthday with a new lover.
Which sets the stage for the foundational trauma. because Captain Walker is liberated from the POW camp and unexpectedly returns home to London.
Oh man, the tension there.
Right, he walks right into his house to find his wife in the arms of another man. A violent confrontation erupts, and little four-year-old Tommy watches as his father shoots the lover to death through a large mirror.
It is such a visceral, horrifying image to put on stage. And the psychological damage doesn't even stop with the gunshot.
No, it gets worse.
The parents suddenly realize their toddler just witnessed a murder. In a total panic, they grab Tommy. They violently shake him, screaming at him that he didn't see anything, he didn't hear anything, and he will never say a word to anyone.
And Tommy's brain just snaps to protect itself.
Yeah, he develops psychosomatic deafness, muteness, and blindness. He retreats entirely inward, just gazing at that mirror in absolute silence.
Now, if we look back at the original 1969 album, that inciting incident was placed in a completely different era.
Right, it wasn't World War II.
Exactly. The album was set just after World War I. In fact, the song detailing the murder was literally titled 1921.
And then there was the 1975 film adaptation, directed by Ken Russell, which took things in yet another wild direction.
Oh, the film is a trip. The film moved the timeline forward to post-World War II, renaming the song 1951, but the movie made a massive fundamental reversal to the plot.
This is the part that blows my mind.
On screen, the lover is the one who kills the father.
Wow.
Yeah, and the lover then assumes the role of Tommy's oppressive stepfather.
Wait, I have to ask about that, because does changing who dies, the father versus the lover, fundamentally change the psychological burden placed on Tommy?
Oh, absolutely.
Because sitting in the audience, watching a murderous stepfather feels completely different than watching your own biological father commit the crime.
What's fascinating here is how that specific choice shifts the emotional weight of the entire show. In the film, Tommy is a classic victim of an external villain.
Right. The stepfather is just a bad guy doing bad things.
Exactly. But for the 1993 stage musical, Townsend and McAnuff returned to the original album's dynamic. The father kills the lover.
Wow.
And by keeping the father alive and in the picture, the trauma is rooted in this profound, inescapable family guilt.
So the captain just gets away with the murder.
Well, he is tried and found not guilty by reason of self-defense.
Well, exactly.
But his punishment is much worse than prison. He has to live every single day with a son who is a walking, catatonic monument to his sin.
Every time he looks at Tommy, he sees the damage he caused.
Exactly. The story is continually updated to anchor the trauma in a war that resonates with the contemporary audience, showing how generational trauma is passed down.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, World War II felt immediately recognizable and poignant for audiences in the 90s while keeping that crushing guilt squarely on the parents' shoulders.
And that heavy psychological burden creates a terrifying vulnerability for Tommy. I mean, he's a blank slate, entirely unresponsive to the outside world.
He can't defend himself at all.
Right. And the parents are exhausted, trying to figure out a cure, so they leave him with family members. And the stage musical really leans into the darkness of the source material here.
It refuses to look away from the reality of child exploitation. Tommy is left with cousin Kevin, who acts as a sadistic bully, inflicting pain just to see if he can get a reaction out of the kid.
It's awful.
And later, he is left with Uncle Ernie, an alcoholic who sexually abuses him.
So when you are entirely cut off from human empathy and subjected to that kind of horrific abuse, where does your brain go to survive?
It seeks out patterns.
Exactly. It seeks out patterns. And for Tommy, that pattern is found in a machine. Cousin Kevin takes him to a youth club, and despite being deaf, mute, and blind, Tommy discovers the pinball machine.
He can feel the vibrations.
Yeah. He understands the mechanics purely through touch, becoming this brilliant player. This gives us the iconic sequences for Sensation and Pinball Wizard.
Pinball represents the one area where Tommy exerts any kind of control, even if it is entirely instinctual. Meanwhile, Captain Walker is becoming increasingly desperate.
Because of the guilt.
Right. The guilt is eating him alive, and he is searching the darkest corners of the city for a miracle cure, which leads to the Isle of Dogs and one of the most heavily debated changes made for the Broadway production.
Ah, the Acid Queen scene.
Yes.
So Captain Walker is approached by a hawker who promises a cure for the boy, leading them to a prostitute known as the Gypsy, or the Acid Queen. Now, in the original album in the film, Tommy actually takes drugs from her.
Right. It produces this wild hallucinogenic response.
But in the 1993 stage musical, Captain Walker brings him to the hideout, gets completely horrified by the needles and the environment, and snatches Tommy away before he partakes of anything.
It is a very deliberate narrative pivot by the creators, altering the entire trajectory of Tommy's internal experience.
I have to push back on this narrative choice, though, because think about the tonal whiplash for the audience.
How so?
Well, for a flashy Broadway show in 1993, keeping the brutal child abuse from Uncle Ernie and the violent bullying from Cousin Kevin is incredibly dark. So why sanitize the Acid Queen scene?
That's a fair question.
Right. Why let the kids suffer horrific abuse at home, but pull them away from the drugs? Isn't that hypocritical in terms of what they are willing to show?
It might seem contradictory on the surface, but if we look at the dramaturg, like the internal logic of the storytelling, it actually serves a vital purpose.
Okay, I'm listening.
Pulling Tommy away from the Acid Queen emphasizes Captain Walker's character arc. In that dingy room, the captain hits absolute rock bottom.
He sees what he's doing to his kid.
Yes. He realizes his agonizing guilt is about to make him subject his already broken son to even more trauma. Snatching the boy away is his first genuine act of protective parenting since the murder.
Oh, wow. So he finally puts his son's well-being over his own selfish need for a cure.
Exactly that. Furthermore, it preserves a crucial element of Tommy's character. By preventing him from taking the drugs, the stage musical keeps Tommy as a pure, uncorrupted vessel.
A total blank slate.
Exactly. Because if Tommy had taken hallucinogens, his eventual awakening might be attributed to just a chemical alteration. The creators needed his awakening to be a pure psychological break, which sets up the second act's exploration of purity, projection, and exploitation.
And that awakening is explosive. The Walkers eventually reach a breaking point. They realize Tommy might never be cured. Captain Walker basically gives up and leaves Mrs. Walker alone with him.
She's at the end of her rope.
She really is. Yeah. She is trying desperately to reach her son one last time, screaming at him to just acknowledge her. And in a fit of absolute rage and despair, she smashes the mirror that Tommy is always staring into.
The shattering of that mirror is the psychological key turning in the lock.
It's so poetic.
It is. The trauma began with a mirror, and it ends with one. The physical destruction of the objects that captured his mind literally sets him free. Tommy suddenly becomes fully lucid for the first time since he was 4 years old.
Here's where it gets really interesting, because Act Two is where the show shifts gears completely. The moment Tommy wakes up and sings, "I'm free," he doesn't just go back to a quiet life.
No, not at all.
It is the early 1960s now, the era of massive youth culture movements. The press gets wind of his miraculous recovery. He becomes a massive media sensation.
He starts appearing in packed stadiums.
Yes. Playing pinball with a special helmet that temporarily blinds and deafens him just to recreate his old state for the rabid crowds. He is elevated to the status of a cult figure.
This is where the narrative pivots from a claustrophobic story about family trauma into a sharp, sweeping critique of celebrity worship.
And the hypocrisy of the people around him.
Exactly. The people who hurt him most are suddenly his biggest enablers. Uncle Ernie, the very man who abused him in the dark, now tries to capitalize on Tommy's blinding stardom by selling cheap souvenirs and opening a commercial venture called Tommy's Holiday Camp.
It is the ultimate exploitation. But the pedestal they build for him eventually crumbles.
It always does.
During one of these stadium shows, the frenzy reaches a fever pitch. A teenage fan named Sally Simpson tries to rush the stage just to touch her idol, and she gets brutally pummeled by the security guards.
It's a really shocking moment.
Yeah, and Tommy sees this violence committed in his name, and he is horrified. He stops the show. He realizes his fame is entirely toxic, so he invites all his fans back to his house, wanting to strip away the celebrity and just welcome them equally.
Which brings us to the most profound and telling alteration Townsend made for the stage adaptation.
I love this part.
The finale at the Broadway show completely flips the moral conclusion of the original album.
It is a night and day difference. Let's look at the 1969 album first. When the followers gather at his house, Tommy acts like a mystical guru.
Right.
He tells them that to reach true enlightenment, they need to suffer like he did. He instructs them to put corks in their ears, cover their eyes, and put pins in their mouths. He demands they become deaf, mute, and blind.
And the crowd obviously rejects him. They revolt.
But step into the St. James Theater in 1993, and the message is entirely different. When Sally Simpson asks Tommy how she can be more like him, he looks at her in confusion.
He doesn't get it.
No. He tells the crowd there is no reason to be like him. He points out that they already possess the amazing gifts of sight and sound that he was deprived of for most of his life. He tells them to abandon this cult mentality and just go live normal, grounded lives.
And what happens?
They still reject him. They sing, "We're not going to take it," and they storm out. It's such a brilliant, tragic irony. Whether Tommy acts like a demanding mystical guru or a completely grounded normal guy telling them to appreciate everyday reality, the crowd's reaction is identical.
Violent rejection.
Yes.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, this reveals a deeply uncomfortable truth about human nature and the mechanics of celebrity.
Absolutely.
The fans in that crowd do not actually care about Tommy's well-being. They do not care about the little boy who suffered in silence for decades. They want a spiritual leader who provides easy, bold answers to their own complicated lives.
They want a shortcut to enlightenment, and they want him to carry the burden of being their messiah.
Precisely the point. When Tommy offers them mundane reality, when he essentially says, hey, I don't have the magical answers, go live your life, the illusion shatters.
Right.
He fails to provide the profound, otherworldly wisdom they projected onto him. Because he refuses to play the role in the grand supernatural narrative they created in their own heads, they turn on him in sheer anger.
It is chilling to think about. He realizes his fame wasn't a celebration of his miraculous recovery. It was born entirely from his fans' desperation for a leader.
So what does he do?
So with the crowd gone, he turns to the only people left his family, the family he ignored during his stadium days. He embraces them, accepting his past, reuniting with the younger, traumatized versions of himself on stage. He finds peace in quiet reality, not in the spotlight.
Which highlights a fascinating real-world paradox surrounding this property.
Oh, the irony here is just too good.
Right. Despite the story delivering a harsh, undeniable critique of commercial exploitation and mindless celebrity worship, the musical itself became an unstoppable commercial juggernaut.
The irony is incredibly thick. I mean, think about it. In the show, you literally have a musical number highlighting Uncle Ernie exploiting Tommy's cult, following by selling cheap plastic souvenirs to gullible fans.
Yeah.
And yet in the real world, the success of the musical inspired a literal commercial pinball machine.
You can't make it up.
Data East manufactured the Who's Tommy Pinball Wizard machine using music and artwork based directly on the Broadway production. It was actually the third Who-themed machine, following the Wizard and Captain Caff Fantastic machines from the 1970s.
It is the ultimate paradox of popular art. The scathing critique of merchandising was heavily merchandised.
Totally.
Great art often becomes absorbed into the very machine it sets out to critique. But the commercialization doesn't dilute the emotional impact of the work itself.
Clearly not, because the story has incredible staying power. Decades after that 1993 run, it is still finding new audiences.
It really is.
Des McAnuff actually returned to direct a 30th anniversary revival. It premiered at the Goodman Theater in Chicago in 2023 and then transferred right back to Broadway at the Niederlander Theater in March 2024.
And that production brought a whole new visual language to the story, winning an Outer Critics Circle Award for its video and projections. The new actor playing Tommy, Aleelu Borsky, won a Theater World Award for his performance.
That's amazing.
Furthermore, a major North American tour is officially set to launch from Playhouse Square in Cleveland, Ohio, in the fall of 2026.
So it's still going strong.
The fact that a concept album from 1969 is still touring the country in 2026 proves that its core thematic material about trauma, healing, and the dangers of projecting our desires onto strangers still deeply resonates.
So what does this all mean for you as you listen to this today? The story of The Who's Tommy isn't just a collection of great classic rock songs or a loud, flashy Broadway spectacle. It is a mirror.
It really forces us to look at our own relentless desire to put broken people on pedestals.
Exactly. We want our celebrities to be flawless, or at least beautifully tragic in a way that serves our entertainment needs. And the moment they step out of the little box we built for them, we tear them down.
We demand that public figures perform their trauma for our consumption, and when they simply want to heal, set boundaries, and be normal, the public feels betrayed.
It brings us right back to that architectural blueprint built on a vibe. We construct these massive, towering expectations out of nothing but our own projections, and I'll leave you with this final, provocative thought to ponder. Imagine if Tommy were to miraculously recover today,
right
now, in the era of TikTok, 24/7 influencer culture, and intense parasocial relationships.
Oh, wow.
If Tommy logged onto a live stream and told his millions of followers to just put down their phones, stop worshiping him, and go live a normal life, would the internet simply reject him for being boring? Or would they ruthlessly, systematically cancel him for failing to live up to the impossible brand they created for him in their own heads?